from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The first hospice opened in the United States in 1974, and in 40 short years, it has transformed how Americans die. Hospice, though, is also a big business, a $14 billion industry that's now dominated by for-profit enterprises. How the hospice movement grew to the point where it now provides care for almost half of all Americans who die each year is the subject of a revealing new book about life and death in America. It's called Changing the Way We Die. We'll talk with co-author Sheila Himmel and Fran Smith after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Dying used to happen fast. Pneumonia, stroke, heart attack, all brought life to a quick close. But dying has become a process. Death lingers. Medical technology often forces us to make choices about the amount and kind of care we receive at the end of life. But our end-of-life options have also been shaped by a phenomenon that didn't even exist 40 years ago in this country, hospice. Today, nearly half of all Americans who die each year receive hospice care. Yet, plenty of misconceptions about it still abound. Hospice isn't a place, for example. Most hospice care happens at home. Nor does hospice mean giving up. What hospice is and how it's transformed end-of-life care in this country is the subject of a new book called Changing the Way We Die. The co-authors are Fran Smith and Sheila Himmel, and they join us now. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us, Dave.
Thanks for being with us, Fran.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. I want to just start by the simplest in some ways, Sheila Himmel, and that's by defining what the it is, because I think there is still this thought that hospice is a place you go as opposed to a kind of care you receive. Give us your definition.
Right. That myth persists. And when you say a place to go, it's a place no one ever wants to go. When in fact, hospice is a way to live rather than a way to die. It's a philosophy of life that is so helpful to people who face these very difficult choices and helps them make them. It includes help with things as mundane as finding somebody to help you with your taxes through spiritual care, if that's what you're interested in. And it's not just about the patient. It's the patient as a whole person, but also it's about the family. And it continues after the patient dies.
Fran Smith, when someone makes the decision, what are they actually deciding? Because with Medicare, for example, there are rules that it will only support hospice care if you are only expected to live 6 more months. So what are you deciding when you say, yes, I'm ready for hospice? What is it that you're saying yes to?
You are saying yes to a comprehensive package of services, often at home, as you said, and social work support, palliative medicine for control of symptoms, support for the family, as Sheila just said. And as you said, you have to have a diagnosis, a terminal diagnosis, and an expectation that you have 6 months to live. And under Medicare, and this is one of the barriers to hospice care, you also have to agree to forego any potentially curative or life-prolonging treatment for your primary illness.
And so there's a sense when you say, especially that last part of the definition of what hospice care, when it can begin and what it might involve, that you are giving up. When people say that, as you and Sheila researched and interviewed and talked to people about this book, or might have that reaction, perhaps people listening right now, that hospice means giving up, how do you respond to that?
Well, we have stories in our book about exactly that. People who made the choice to discontinue aggressive medical treatment and go with hospice, and the time that they bought for themselves by doing that was they could do remarkable things. One of them wrote a book. One of them was a 92-year-old woman who was able to meet her first great-grandchild because of the time that hospice gave her to be with her family.
Friend Smith, what would you add to that?
Well, we found that people were able to reclaim their lives in so many ways. And it could be as simple as just not running back and forth to the emergency room or spending a lot of time in an ICU hooked up to machines. And really, you know, one of the surprises for us was that everybody had a different definition of what a good death would mean to them. And hospice really supported them to realize that.
You raise this interesting question in the book, and Fran Smith, I'd like you to describe what you mean by this, that you say that part of hospice is, in effect, asking yourself, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? Why is that the question that hospice, in fact, prompts?
You know, it was so interesting. We heard that from the story of a patient, and he was 50, and when he was facing this choice, when he was diagnosed with a rare leukemia, an aggressive leukemia, and he went through 4.5 years of brutal treatment and was appalled when a friend suggested he consider hospice. And he finally agreed to meet with the hospice social worker just to hear their services. He really didn't know much about hospice. And that was the question that the social worker posed to him. It really wasn't, how do you want to die, but what do you want to do with the rest of your life? And nobody, you know, he had a diagnosis. He could have lived 6 more months. He could have lived another year. But it was really the question that allowed him to get his brain around hospice as a choice that could open up possibilities and not, as we said earlier, just a way of giving up.
You write in the book, Sheila Himmel, that we should think about hospice as actually being the most successful part of our healthcare system, which is really interesting and maybe damning with faint praise, I don't know. But why do you consider it that? What is it that makes it the most successful part of our healthcare system?
Well, in terms of consumer satisfaction, people say that over and over again, families who've had experience with hospice, that they wished they'd known about it sooner, and it was the best aspect of medical care. We heard that over and over again. Now, I think that reflects on the team-based aspect of hospice, that you're dealing with several people, not just one very tired person, and that it includes medical, social, emotional, and spiritual care if you want it. So it treats not only the patient but the family as like a whole person. People feel listened to.
Paint a picture, if you would, Fran Smith, of how this might work. Story perhaps from your book about how the way the different services, the different ways in which people interact, that makes this real in terms of what it is people actually get when they say, I'm going to participate in hospice.
Well, I'll come back to the man I was talking about earlier, and I'll start, and I know Sheila spent a lot of time with his family, and I'll turn it over to her. But when he decided to opt for hospice, equipment came to his house, the medicine came to his house, so that eliminated these endless trips to the hospital that would take all day and that would just be exhausting for him and his wife. Sheila, do you want to talk a little bit more about that situation?
Yeah, so that had gone on for this family for 4.5 years. And they'd moved back to the Bay Area to be near family because they knew that they were facing the end.
And this is someone, again, repeat what his prognosis was, what he was
had,
facing.
He had AML, a rare blood leukemia, and he had still stem cell transplant. He'd had hundreds of transfusions. He'd spent 600 nights in 6 different hospitals. I mean, this statistics of what this man went through are just, whenever we read those, people just like cringe. So they got to this point where a friend suggested hospice, and the man's name, by the way, is Rusty Hammer, and it might ring a bell for people in the Bay Area because he was a dynamo in politics in the 70s, and he was elected to the city council of Campbell in Silicon Valley at the age of 18, making him the youngest ever. So it made national news and everything. But as we said, when he turned 50, he started having back pain, and it turned out to be this rare cancer. So the choice was to continue these treatments, and he could tell that his wife was just worn out. Or when the social worker came in, and it was this young guy, and I think they looked at him and like, well, what does he know? But he posed the question. He said, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? Do you want to is there someone you need to mend fences with? Do you want to? Is there anywhere you want to vote? You want to go? Do you want? Is there anything you want to do? And it turned out Rusty wanted to write a book. And in the 4.5 months that he was on hospice, he was able to do that. And the local high school was performing the play Wit at the time, and they came over and interviewed him. He was able to have a book party. So it was kind of, it was remarkable.
And it's what can't happen in so often if you don't make that choice. And I just want to read something that you quote early on in the book from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross' famous book on death and dying, where she writes this about how frequently people are facing the end of life. She writes, a patient may cry for peace and dignity, but he will get infusions, transfusions, a heart machine, or tracheotomy. He may want one single person to stop for one single minute so that he can ask one single question, but he will get a dozen people around the clock, all busily occupied with his heart rate, pulse, electrocardiogram, or pulmonary functions, his secretions or excretions, but not with him as a human being. Is that, Fran Smith, at the essence of what hospice does, that it focuses on the human being, not all of the test results?
Right. It's definitely the alternative scenario. And, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross described this in the late 1960s, and we've come such a long way in the ability of patients to express their wishes, to have their wishes known, to avoid that kind of thing. But, those kinds of things still go on in hospitals today.
One of the things that was striking to me about your book and is how difficult it clearly is for doctors still to talk about death. You describe Sheila Himmel, and I don't know which of you covered this part of the story, but it's where some medical students go through an exercise where a woman role plays the role of someone who is facing death, and they just really can't even seem to say the word. They wind up using word. They talk about metastasize, but they don't say you're going to die. Can you describe what that is? Still has to be done, I guess, so that the conversation changes with doctors in particular.
Well, I will start with that, but that the medical students were Fran was there, so I'll turn it over to her. But I spoke with my own internist about this, and she said, because we criticize doctors a lot for not bringing this up and wanting to do ever more tests and treatments, and she said, you say the word hospice and people just freak out. It's such a loaded word. So I kind of get why the language is difficult for doctors, but Fran can tell you about the medical students.
Well, yeah, I did observe that, and it was so interesting because it was an actor who is trained to do this kind of role playing, and I was crying watching her. She really was a very persuasive cancer patient, and the scenario is that she was coming to learn test results, and she was very hopeful that the test results would show that her cancer had stopped advancing, and the students and the medical students had to break the news that actually the cancer had progressed, was continuing to progress, and further chemotherapy was not going to stop it. And they had such a hard time. There were students crying. Now, these were fourth-year medical students, and it was so compelling for them. And in a way, while it was interesting to see the difficulty they had after 4 years of medical school in having these conversations, it was also really great to see medical students engaging in this kind of exercise, because 5 and certainly 10 years ago, this was not a part of the medical curriculum.
There was a piece in The New Yorker a while ago by Dr. Atul Gawande, who on this same topic, and he writes in that according to a study, and I'm sorry, I don't recall the reference, but something like 40% of all oncologists say that they offer treatments that they think are unlikely to work, which is so striking. And I'm just interested, Fran Smith, in what your perception is about that, that it's almost – it feels like it's almost something that within the DNA of the profession, where you want to always be offering something, even when that something isn't likely to work.
Well, doctors are trained to save lives, and, you know, that's great for all of us. So we don't want to come down on doctors here. And there's always that little chance, is I think the logic. You know, yeah, 80% of the time, 90% of the time might not work, but maybe it will. We can throw this at it. And, you know, of course, in this country with insurance, we generally don't have to even think about the costs of that. You know, just try. It's very interesting because in the book we look at how doctors themselves look at things like advance directives, and they're much more likely than the rest of us to have all this paperwork done. They don't want this futile, brutal care at the end of life. And, you know, and all of us as the public, we so overestimate how the likelihood of success of most medical treatments like CPR and all that kind of thing. We think it's going to work. And depending on the treatment, that isn't necessarily the case.
In that same article, Gwendy cites the story of the sort of pushback on this, and from the writer Stephen Jay Gould, who was diagnosed with a form of cancer in which the median life expectancy was 8 months. And he did some research on this, and he wound up writing a piece called "The Median Is Not the Message," because he learned that while that's the median, there were many people who did survive, or at least some people who did survive longer, and he wanted to be one of those people, and in fact did live for 20 more years. And he wrote in that essay, and I just want to read this quote because I think it's the pushback that I'd love to hear you both respond to. And Gould wrote, "It's my view that it's become a bit too trendy to regard the acceptance of death as something tantamount to intrinsic dignity. I prefer the more martial view that death is the ultimate enemy, and I find nothing reproachable in those who rage mightily against the dying of the light." Sheila Himmel.
Right. Well, I would agree. I mean, when we say a good death, it doesn't mean that it's fun or everybody's, you know, happy. But it's a reality. And the reality is, if we plan ahead rather than wait for a crisis, it will be better for everybody, particularly, you know, for the survivors, because what are they going to remember about your last days? Particularly, you know, in the ICU is a good example. It's horrible. We think of the ICU as a place, well, we can go there and be, you know, saved. And when they perform CPR on TV, it's always successful. But in reality, it's rarely successful.
So as part of what people ought to think about, Fran Smith, that you may want to choose to wage the battle, as Stephen Jay Gould suggests, but prepare for the alternative, prepare for the battle not working out?
Well, yes, that's part of it, and also to just know what the choices are out there.
Yeah.
You know, we are not in the book, we don't hold up hospice as the way to go. But many more people would be using hospice, I think, if the public were well informed. And even though you said, you know, nearly half of all deaths take place in hospice, most people come in very late. They come in too late to get a lot of benefit from it.
And why is that? Why do people come to it, I think, only usually for the average of something like 20 days of their lives, when it could be something that could have been perhaps of assistance for much longer? Fran Smith?
Well, for the reasons that we're talking about, you know, there's that hope that, you know, however slim, that the next drug or treatment or surgery will do the trick or buy some time. The way it's presented as giving up and not presented as a choice that you can make and a way to reclaim the time that you do have left. And, you know, our own fears about and myths about what that really means to choose hospice.
Do you think it's a mistake, Sheila Himmel, that the Medicare requirement is that you, by choosing to enter into hospice, that you therefore forego the opportunity for any further curative treatment?
Definitely. That's the care versus cure dilemma, and that it sets up an impossible choice. Of course you would choose. It's very hard to say give up care. I mean, sorry, cure, if there's any possibility. But in fact, there are studies now about concurrent care. When people with terminal diagnosis are offered palliative care.
Which is comfort care,
essentially. Which is comfort care, which is what hospice does, but without having to give up the possibility of curative treatment. They go with that, and they hardly ever, you ask for the more extensive treatment.
And are there not also, Fran Smith, studies that indicate that even when you do make that choice, that people who make the choice for hospice actually wind up living just as long often as people who don't make that choice within, I think, some forms of cancer in particular?
Right. Well, there's some great research, and it wasn't necessarily hospice, but one of the great shifts in medicine that we've seen recently is that palliative care, this approach of, you know, symptom control and family support and this comprehensive kind of approach is really moving upstream in the medical system. So through palliative care services in hospitals, it's available to patients who are not enrolled in specifically in hospice care. And so there was a great study a few years ago that showed patients with advanced lung cancer who were offered palliative care really at the time that they were diagnosed. And some people had no palliative care. Some people had palliative care. They all had the option of having chemotherapy. And the palliative care group not only got opted for less mainstream treatment, less chemotherapy, but they actually live longer than the straight chemotherapy group.
Fran Smith and Sheila Himmel join us this hour. Again, the book is called Changing the Way We Die, Compassionate End of Care and the Hospice Movement. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take your calls on this subject. If you have had the experience of having a family member receive hospice care, we'd love to hear from you about what that care was like. If you have had the experience of not using hospice care for a family member, we'd love to hear your story as well. You can join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your thoughts or questions on our Facebook page or on our website. We have lots of comments coming in online already, some positive, some critical of hospice. We'll get to those and hear more of those stories when we return. Sheila Himmel, Fran Smith, the book is Changing the Way We Die. We'll talk more when we return. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guests this hour, Fran Smith and Sheila Himmel, their book is called Changing the Way We Die, Compassionate End-of-Life Care and the Hospice Movement. We welcome your contributions to our conversation as well at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Let's go right to our calls. Dave in Marin joins us first. Dave, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you so much for taking on this important topic. My family went through the wrenching experience a few years back of losing our father. And he had made out a will that dictated that he did not want any extraordinary measures. Even in that case, I can tell you it was the most wrenching decision we had ever made, I had ever made, to actually move him to hospice. But in retrospect, it was probably the greatest gift that he gave us, making up that will, and that we gave him.
Dave, thank you. Friends Smith, it's such an important point about taking the time to do that for everyone's benefit. There's also something you reference in the book called the Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment, the POLST, POLST form. But you also make the point in the book that it's not just about filling out the form or checking off something on a checklist. And it sounds like this happened in Dave's family, that there really has to be a deeper conversation to go along with filling out the right forms.
Right. I could tell you from my own experience, my father, and the genesis of the book was really the deaths of my father and Sheila's father, both our fathers, and talking about our different experiences. But when my father died, it was after a very long decline, 10-year decline, and he died in a hospital, and he died of pneumonia, and we declined on that last hospitalization to treat him with antibiotics because he was just very incapacitated at that point. And we had gone and looked at only at that point, after 10 years, did we actually kind of dig out his forms that he had signed years earlier and saw that that was one of the things he had listed as an option. You know, if he had no hope of meaningful recovery, he didn't want to be treated for pneumonia with antibiotics. Over the years of this decline, and he'd been in very bad shape for at least five of those 10 years, we went back and forth to the hospital several times and had him treated for pneumonia, and we never looked at that form. We kind of thought of that form as something that had to do with extraordinary measures, you know, feeding tubes or breathing machines. We never thought of anything kind of as basic as antibiotics. So really, the paperwork is important, but there's no substitute for the conversation. And one of the messages in the book is to have the conversation before the crisis. The worst time to start to get your brain around this is when the crisis occurs.
Teresa writes, "My father died in hospice care and was able to be surrounded by his family, and even his dog was allowed to be on the bed. His wife was allowed to sleep in the room on a bed they brought to him. It took over a week for him to die after the stroke, and the hospice in Turlock made us feel taken care of as well as him. The staff was warm and supportive, as well as other families around us going through the same thing." Let's take another call next from Sue in Oakland. Sue, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for, again, addressing this very important topic. I, about 20-some years ago, went through the hospice volunteer program so that I could take care of my mother, who was dying of cancer. And I'm just curious now, that many years later, the difference between, say, somebody who has cancer and it's clear that they have a specific amount of time left, or, I mean, we never know, but and someone who, for example, has Alzheimer's and is on hospice, wishes to die at home, at what point is the decision made and how is that handled, bringing a person home who's, as I said, been in hospice and is dying, but it's kind of unknown how long that person might be?
Well, a couple of different questions, I think, within Sue's question, Sheila Himmel. But let's take up the Alzheimer's part of this first, because it's an interesting point about Fran was just talking about the importance of having the conversation. It's harder to have the conversation sometimes if someone's cognitive abilities are diminished.
Right, which is why we're saying it's never too late to have the conversation. It's also never too early. In fact, anyone over 18 really should have advance directives, so that if you're incapacitated and can't speak for yourself, it's written. And if you know think about it, do it for your family, if not for yourself, because they'll be in crisis and horrible pain having to make a decision for you. They'll want to know, really written down, what it is that you would have wanted. Otherwise, it's really not
fair to the family.
And Fran Smith, on the other part of Sue's question about people sort of perhaps going in and out of hospice care, because that's also possible. People can be in hospice and then be moved off of hospice and then back on again. I think that's not very commonly understood. I didn't understand it until I read that in your book. Can you describe how that works exactly?
Yes, and you know, it comes back to the first part of her question on Alzheimer's patients, because this might happen more with Alzheimer's patients who are harder to predict. It's harder to predict the course of that. Generally, the patient, if the physician feels that you need a physician referral for hospice care. So, you know, if there's general agreement that this person, if they're not treated for all kinds of, you know, ailments, would likely not be here in 6 months, then they could be eligible for hospice care. And actually, more than 50% of hospice patients now are non-cancer. So that includes a bunch of things: kidney failure, congestive heart failure, Alzheimer's, and dementia. So hospice is really – it started off being primarily for cancer. It no longer is. But if patients outlive that six-month diagnosis, in some cases, they can be recertified and continue on hospice care. In some cases, they go off hospice care until they really start a decline again and really need that kind of support.
Sue, thanks for the call. Carol writes, I was neutral to positive about hospice until my dad's death under hospice care. The peacefulness that can make the family happy is induced with high doses of morphine to the point that the dying person stops breathing and their heart stops. While I think euthanasia can be appropriate, it ought to be chosen by the dying person, and they cannot be said to be making a choice when morphine is administered on a schedule to an unconscious person. The hospice organization failed to provide me with the information that I needed. Sheila Hemel, what's your reaction to Carol's comment?
I am sorry that things like that do happen, that it should never happen, but it's an important point. Hospices do vary in quality, and some have more highly trained staff than others. I mean, they are trained in pain control, and that it should be managed, and the family should be informed about what the condition that the patient's. I have to say that in my father's case,
who did receive hospice care
and did receive morphine, and his death was very peaceful. My mother and my sister and I were there, and we couldn't have done it without the hospice. The hospice staff, and particularly the nurse, was there at every step to tell us what to expect and what was normal and what we could do and what maybe we didn't have to worry about.
Fran Smith, how do you go about evaluating hospice care if someone, as Carol writes, if that's testimony to something that can happen, where there wasn't apparently enough communication between hospice and the family members? Is there a way to research hospice services? Is there a way to – I don't know if there's a Yelp for hospice, but how do you go about figuring out what service might be best for your situation?
Well, I have to say there is Yelp for hospice.
I should have known.
So you can see the reviews, and, you know, as Yelp for restaurants or anything else, you have to take it with a grain of salt. But, yeah, there, you know, it's a great question, because most communities, and certainly, you know, in the Bay Area, there are a number of programs, and it is important to check out the program and to shop around. And, of course, we don't think about that when we get a hospice referral and are dealing with a dying loved one, but it's very important. And you know, I'll just give you three things. One is is the medical director, and that's really the MD the doctor who's in charge of the program. Is that person board certified in palliative medicine, which is the specialty that is about pain management and comfort care? And the second thing is, who is the team you'll be working with? Will you consistently see the same doctor, nurse, social worker, or will you have a rotating cast of characters? Ideally, you want the consistency, because it's important to develop those personal bonds and the communication that goes with it. And then third, how are you treated when you make that first phone call or have that first visit and ask questions like this? Is someone taking as much time as you need to address your concerns? Or are they busy with the paperwork or looking to get to the next meeting? And we've really, you know, heard so many stories and seen so many instances where that interaction is such a good indicator of the kind of care that you or your loved one ultimately will receive.
Well, let's go into another aspect of that, which is somewhat related, which, and to me was one of the really revealing things about your book, which is that hospice is a big business. It's a $14 billion industry, you write, and that it is now largely dominated. Almost two-thirds of all hospice services are now for-profit. And David writes in a comment about that. He says that the fact that Oregon is the only right-to-die state, I've watched two people close to me be forced to starve themselves in order to die with dignity so that the medical system, hospice included, can make the most profit possible. It's a revenue stream in the guise of caring. Don't know about the specifics, of course, of the story that David is commenting on, Fran Smith, but it is a revenue stream. There's a lot of money to be made in hospice. Give us that part of the story.
Well, yeah, hospice is largely and increasingly a for-profit enterprise. And I just want to correct one thing. Oregon is not the only state that allows physician aid in dying. A number of states have joined that. And but yeah, hospice is a big business, and we have these. A lot of these companies are big chains that are publicly traded on Wall Street, so they're really accountable to investors. And some of the early chains were really they kind of grew out of the hospice movement. But increasingly, we're seeing investors and even private equity firms buy into hospice. You know, companies that have no background in end of life care,
like Roto-Rooter.
Well, yeah. Well, actually, Roto-Rooter is Vitas is owned by ChemMed, which also owns Roto-Rooter. And Vitas actually started – it's the first for-profit, started a long time ago by someone who was very active in the early hospice movement. But you're right. The company that now owns it really comes to it through clogged drains. And Sheila and I come from newspaper background, and it was interesting to us to see the Washington Post company by a hospice company in the Mid-Atlantic. And, you know, we know the Washington Post has sold its legendary newspaper, but it's still in the hospice business.
And did you see in any of your reporting when you visited various hospices, Sheila Himmel in the Bay Area and elsewhere in California, a difference between for-profit hospice services and those that were the more – how we, I guess, like to think of hospice in terms of its sort of nonprofit early origins?
Well, now you consider when you visit a hospice, it's an office mostly because most of the hospice care is done in the home. So I went on home visits with a doctor from Pathways in the Bay Area, which is a nonprofit. There are complaints about both. There are, as the caller mentioned, there are complaints about pain control. That in some cases that the patient is not given enough. But we can't say definitively at this point, you know, for-profit is all bad and nonprofits are, you know, are good doing God's work. But it is, as we keep saying, it's really important to research this with, you know, find somebody who's been through it.
Some people writing in about their own experiences who have been through it. Pat writes, the experience with hospice with my 92-year-old father was overwhelmingly positive. The hospice providers took care of his special end-of-life needs while he was in a nursing home. One of the hospice people played guitar and sang for my father and tried to play the songs that he knew. Jane writes, my personal experience echoes your guest's points of view. However, could you also address the fact that there are many hospice programs and they differ widely? What some offer differs from what others offer. If you live in Florida, for example, you might have access to boutique hospices offering massage and acupuncture and other services. A little bit about what you were saying before, Fran Smith, about what you should look for. Is there anything you should look for in terms of red flags?
Well, I would say if you're dealing with somebody on that first interaction and they are not willing to take as much time as you need, and, you know, that can be an hour. then that is, if they are just too busy to answer your questions, that's not a hospice program that you want to deal with. You know, as Sheila was starting to say before, she went on home visits. I went on home visits, and in every instance of a really great hospice program, we watched doctors sit with patients, talk to them, look them in the eye, spend an hour or an hour and a half in the home, talked with every family member, and really didn't leave that situation until everybody felt listened to, everybody's concerns were addressed. So again, those early interactions you have with a hospice program are really a good indication. And you can switch a hospice program if you're in it. You don't have to stay with that program if you feel you're not getting cared for well.
It sounds like one thing people ought to maybe ask themselves and then ask as they're considering prospective hospice services is how they deal with pain management, because we've had a number of people raise this question. Wendy writes, my dad just died with hospice. Your guests have given a rosy scenario, but my dad didn't have much life to enjoy his last weeks, and his last 40 hours were pretty bad. Our hospice was mostly good, but one complaint I have is that I think they wanted to give him some of the drugs to quiet him, quote unquote, but it was for the living that they did that, not for my dying dad. It sounds like that's something that if you're making your own checklist of things that you want to figure out about hospice, so that's a good question to ask, what the philosophy is in pain management, would you say, Sheila Hemel?
Right, but I would also say that the last few hours of life or the last few days sometimes
it's gonna be hard.
Are not going to be pretty. And my father had moments of gagging, and there was this breathing that he'd start breathing and not, But what was helpful to us was all of that, which was very scary. But the hospice people were there to say, this is what's going on. The body does in the last moments of life. And they call it active dying. And what's really useful is you're talking with someone who has been through it before, because when families are in this position, you kind of feel like you're all alone and no one's ever done this before. But the hospice person can tell you what to expect.
Back to our calls. Jim is next in San Francisco. Jim, go ahead.
Hi, this is Jim. I was trained by and worked with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross as a facilitator in her life, death, and transition workshops back in the 80s. I worked with her for 5 years. And one of Elizabeth's goals was to bring death back into life, such as all tribes throughout the centuries had done. And that is why we have it as a discussion so often today, and families are benefiting from that discussion, and why people who are making their transition can leave peacefully and easily, because there is choice about that.
Jim, thank you. Let's go next to Amy in Lafayette. Amy?
California. My father was living in Florida, in the area around Boca Raton, and I had the most extraordinarily wonderful experience with hospice. He was only on hospice for about 8 or 9 weeks. He was in end-stage Alzheimer's, but he had been in and out of the hospital in the course of 8 or 10 months for a variety of things. And absolutely no one spent the amount of time and had the kind of caring that his hospice care workers did. He changed assisted care facilities once. I was lamenting doing that. I knew it was the right thing because of where he would be living. I was lamenting it because I would have to switch teams, hospice teams, because he was crossing county lines, and they designated a hospice team per county. Well, I went from one extraordinary team to another. They were remarkable people down to the very last hour, down to the phone calls cross country to me and to my sister in New York. I'm a walking advertisement for hospice. I just think they were extraordinary people and made my cross country situation with my father much more agreeable in some way, or much, I don't know what the word is,
yeah,
but it certainly helped me out enormously because I couldn't be there every day for his dying months. And
yeah,
we needed a team. And while we also made sure that he had some other aides in place prior to hospice, far and away, hospice was the best thing we did on behalf of our dad.
Amy, thank you. Thanks for calling in and adding that to our conversation. I want to get to something that we haven't talked about yet, Sheila Himmel, which is the services that hospice provides after someone dies for the survivors. One of the more fascinating and quite moving sections of the book that you return to on several occasions is a place that's called the Birch Room, where people participate in a group, people who have survived the death of a loved one. And there's something, I don't know how common that phenomenon is, I'd be interested to know, the kind of bond that grew in that group, the relationships that blossomed, both friendships but also love relationships. Describe a little of what happened that you saw in the Birch Room.
Well, it came as a huge surprise to everyone. These were people who had lost their partners and were devastated and had some experience with hospice or didn't. It doesn't matter. Hospice mandates, Medicare mandates 13 months of bereavement care that hospices must provide. Now, that varies a lot. It could be just a phone call. But in this case, this is Hospice of the Valley in San Jose. They have bereavement groups that are focused on spouses, children, suicides, all very, very focused, so that you're with a bunch of people who understand what you're going through, and we keep coming back to this this sort of, it's like compassionate listening. They're there to listen, and they're there, and you can keep talking, whereas your family and your friends are kind of like, well, let's get on with our life, and they're worried about you. These groups provide such a good service in a place for people to meet, and in this particular case, three couples came out of the group, which was kind of extraordinary.
So while we think of hospice being focused on that final 6 months of someone's life, it actually provides services that extend, in this case, well beyond that period of time, and mm-hmm. and provides a place. In this case, it does provide a literal place where people can come together.
Right, and they also will have events on holidays, which are very hard for people who are grieving, and other events throughout the year. I mean, the hospice doesn't just drop the family when the patient dies. They keep in touch, and as long as, I mean, they don't force themselves on you, but they are there if you need them.
I want to get to one other aspect of your book, which I also found interesting, and that our the next comment I'm going to read gets to. Debbie writes, I typed this as a caregiver for my terminally ill father. We're receiving home hospice care from the nonprofit Hospice By the Way. It's given him an opportunity to gradually and comfortably decline at home. I should also mention that my dad is a native Mandarin Chinese speaker, and Hospice By the Bay has provided Chinese-speaking team members to support him. For us, it's been an incredible benefit to Dad and our entire family. But, Fran Smith, that's actually an issue to a degree, right? That hospice, in terms of the percentage of people who use hospice services, who are people of color in particular, there's a gap there. Hospice is not something that's necessarily taken in sometimes as readily by people either of different races than Anglo or from different cultures.
Yes, there is a gap, and in the book we describe this inability to reach out to communities of color as really the big failure of the hospice movement until now. Overwhelmingly, 80-something percent of patients are white, and in part, it's the older demographic, but also, if you look in many, many communities, hospice services are really skewed toward white, middle-class patients. Hospice began as kind of a grassroots movement in white middle-class communities, and it has really too much stayed there. Now, we've seen, in the Bay Area in particular and in some other communities, really great efforts to change that, to have staff that's culturally sensitive, culturally aware, to have staff that speaks a variety of languages. And, you know, it's not just doing a straight translation, but really understanding the rituals and customs and taboos around death in any community. So there's been a lot of progress, and especially in the Bay Area. But hospice nationally and as a movement, as an industry, has a long way to go.
Let's comment from each of you about what you hope your book does. It's called Changing the Way We Die. What do you hope people will change in their own lives as they come to this consideration? Fran Smith first.
Well, I hope people understand that there are choices. We don't have a choice about whether we're going to die ultimately, but we often have more choices than we realize about whether that's going to be easier or harder, whether that's going to be a time in hospitals and emergency rooms, or whether that's going to be a time to accomplish things that we might want to accomplish in our lives. And also I hope that what the book does is inspire conversation. We really, all of us, we need to be talking, you know, as a society, we need to be talking with our families about what we want at the end of life. You know, what is the most important thing? Is pain management the most important thing, or do we want to be alert at the end of life? If you have those conversations early, I think some of the callers who've had real concerns about how their loved ones died, some of these concerns could be eased. And some of these decisions could be made much more readily in the moment that you have to make them.
And Sheila Hemel, just a quick last thought.
Well, and I want to also note that there are tools that help you with this. That there are, like, for example, Go Wish cards, which is a takeoff on the kids' game Go Fish, that will help you make this not a painful thing.
And we have some of those resources, by the way, posted on our website. If you go to kqed.org/forum, you can get those some of those resources that Sheila was mentioning. Again, the book, Changing the Way We Die, Compassionate End-of-Life Care and the Hospice Movement. Fran Smith and Sheila Hemel, thanks both very much for being on our program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Danny Bringer is our engineer, Amanda Stupai, our engagement producer, and Dan Zoll, our senior editor. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.